Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Let's just stipulate that somebody is going to get your data, right? Somebody will. But if you could pick just one, which would it be? The NSA or some cyber criminal? Think about that for a second. And while you are, from American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Friday, the 17th of January. Good as always to have you with us. We'll get going with the president's speech about the National Security Agency this afternoon. There will be some changes, the president said, to the way the NSA can use all that telephone data it has, and eventually changes to where the data is stored. There is obviously much more to come in that story, what Congress and the courts want to do about it, for example. But data and its uses aren't the sole purview of the federal government, you know. Investigators now say the data breach at Target could get a whole lot bigger. They think, apparently, it's part of a huge and sophisticated international attack against a broad swath of retailers, which kind of leaves the data supplying public between a rock and a hard place. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
So what's worse? The government sifting through your data like a character from some Orwellian nightmare? Or a data thief getting a hold of your credit card number?
The criminals are a bigger and more immediate threat.
Stephen Cobb is a security researcher at ESET North America. He says data breaches make us vulnerable to identity theft, which can destroy people's credit and take years to sort out.
One of the big drivers of our economy is improved use of electronic communications. And if people are spooked into not using that, that has an impact on the economy.
Others are more worried about the government collecting our data. Barrett Lyon is the CEO of Defense.net.
I want to be able to shop and not worry about losing my credit card's information. But I also want to be able to chat with my wife online and not worry about somebody deciding to use that against me in the future.
It's not the data the government is collecting that worries Aram Sinright, author of The Piracy Crusade. It's the data about the data.
The NSA is able to infer things like what your sexual orientation is, what your religion is, what your income is, simply by looking at what's known as the metadata, the information about the information that you transact. We cannot trust anybody to hold that kind of power without misusing it at some point.
Sinright says Target and the NSA are two sides of the same coin. Our data is being collected and used in ways we can't control. And that can mean an evil government trying to crush you, or just some guy trying to charge a steak dinner to your Amex card. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
She says it so plainly. All right, with all that as backdrop, we will spend some time going back over the week that was. For that, Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville is with us. Neil Richardson from Bloomberg Government is also here. They are both in our Washington studios. Hey, guys.
Hey, Kai.
So let's move away from data for a second, Cardiff, and get to the politics of the American economy. First of all, we have a budget for the first time in a long, long while.
We do, although I really just don't think that we should all be high-fiving ourselves because Congress finally decided to do its job.
But it hasn't done its job in like 5 years, yo.
You're right. I'm just saying we're kind of holding the expectations bar really low, so it's easy to step over. And by the way, you know, Politico made an interesting point earlier this morning, which is that the size of this budget, okay, is smaller if you adjust for inflation than George W. Bush's budget was 6 years ago.
Wow.
So if you, like me, think that, you know, Congress and the government and fiscal policymakers haven't done enough to support the economy, this still isn't really that much to get excited about.
Neela, are they high-fiving themselves in Washington?
No, they're getting ready for the debt ceiling debate, I think.
Oh, man, you are such a buzzkill. Holy cow.
That's why you come to me.
That's right. That's right. It's a file under buzzkill.
I think there are bigger fish to fry on the fiscal picture, and they're going to fry them in February when they can really hold the Treasury's head underwater on this issue of the debt ceiling. So let's expect that Congress will pick up the pace on the dissension and really try to get some of their issues in tandem with this agreement.
That's kind of a gruesome image, holding Treasury's head under the water.
Do you really think,
Neela, that the debt limit fight is going to be real this time? I mean, we got so close last time and it all worked out. Why isn't that going to be the case this time?
I think it will all work out. But, you know, the theatrics surrounding it will keep us on the edge of our seat. this time as well. We've seen this movie. You know, they always say the sequel is not as exciting as the first one, so maybe it won't be as exciting this time around.
Hey, Cardiff, so another thing in Washington, actually, is, as long as we're talking about it, unemployment benefits, which expired December the 28th for 1.3 million people, long-term unemployment benefits, they just kind of died in the Senate, and it seems to me like nobody noticed. They went away, and was it.
You know, and it's really too bad because even if the economic case for extending these benefits weren't strong, the humanitarian case is incredibly strong. This is a class of people that tends to be discriminated against in the workplace. The effects of long-term unemployment are incredibly debilitating financially and psychologically. And yet the economic case for doing it is also very strong. This is money that would almost immediately be spent and be circulated back into the economy. So this is just, I think, another example of Congress shooting itself in the foot.
Neil, a reality check here. Will the reinstatement of these benefits come back, or is it really and truly gone?
I hope so, Kai. I couldn't agree with Cardiff more on this one. If they don't come back, up to 5 million people will lose their benefits this year. So this is a real crisis for people. And so there is some bipartisan agreement, not a lot, but enough to get an extension passed through Congress, at least passed through the Senate. So this is something to watch in terms of getting goodwill to Congress again and solving a real problem in the economy.
All right. Last question for the week, a bit of a retrospective. Ben Bernanke, the outgoing chairman of the Fed, made his last, what is probably going to be his last public appearance this week at a seminar at the Brookings Institution. Neela, I was struck by a lot of what he said, but mostly by the fact that he said communication was so difficult. It was so hard for him to get the message out about what he was trying to do.
Yes, in the age of the social world, communication's hard, even for the Fed. And he also talked about the reputation cost that the Fed is still experiencing for saving the economy in terms of the backlash, the political backlash from QE and all of the money that was spent rescuing these insolvent financial institutions. I think going forward, communication in the Fed is going to be critical in meandering the taper and reducing that stimulus to the economy.
I will be curious to see how Janet Yellen does at that first press conference and see exactly what it's like, since it was part of her idea for the Fed to be more communicative. Quickly, outgoing thoughts about Ben Bernanke?
You know, I think the immediate sort of take on his legacy is that he acted splendidly and boldly and cleverly when a crisis was really looming. But in the time since the crisis was stabilized, he made monetary policy lurch in the right direction. Hmm. He made it more transparent and he improved communications, but he didn't do it aggressively enough. And because of that, we've experienced this period of very sluggish growth. But I mean, there's a lot more to be studied on this, and it will be studied for many years, if not decades to come.
And you'll hear about it here. Cardiff Garcia from the blog FT Alphaville and Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you,
thanks,
Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right, have a good weekend. On Wall Street today, it was a split decision. Details, numbers, you know the drill. The weather forecast for most of California today is dry, continued dry through forever. It's that way here in L.A., up in the Central Valley, in San Francisco as well, just dry. Warm, too, which I guess is nice if you live in colder and wetter places. But here, that's called a state of emergency. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has the story.
This morning, California Governor Jerry Brown made it official.
Today, I'm declaring a drought emergency in the state of California.
Brown's been under pressure for weeks from farmers, farm workers, and the various folks who represent them. But as he said, this is the worst drought in the state's recorded history, and the governor can't make it rain. What water there is gets moved around the state, and Brown's declaration does open the door for farmers to ask for a bigger share. Gail Holman is with the Westlands Water District. It distributes that water to farmers in the state's Central Valley region, and this obviously means jobs for workers and money for farmers there. But the region has major reach.
Anything that you are consuming for dinner tonight, I would imagine, originated right here in the Central Valley.
Especially if you're thinking about a salad, tomatoes, lettuce, almonds, glass of wine, that's nearby too. Holman says right now, farmers are holding back from planting about a third of the Central Valley's 600,000 acres. And this is not just California either. The U.S. Department of Agriculture recently declared parts of 11 western states official disaster areas, including all of Oregon. Did you know there's one area there that produces most of our yellow onions? What does that mean for grocery baskets around the country? Phil Limbert is editor of The Supermarket Guru.
It means means that foods are going to be more expensive. And matter of fact, this is not a surprise. We've been hearing from the USDA and from the weather folks that we're going to have more weather problems for probably the next 15 to 20 years.
Yeah, he means climate change. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
The economics of money can be interesting. Not the economics of money as in bond yields and mortgage rates, the boring stuff, but the economics of actual money. How much it costs to make a coin or a bill versus what that coin or bill is actually worth. The Wall Street Journal reports that the U.S. Mint is considering changing up the metals that go into our coinage to make production of them less expensive. A nickel, for instance, is worth a nickel, but it costs almost twice that to make. A government agency trying to save money sounds like a good thing, but of course, nothing is ever that easy, as Marketplace's Noel King tells us.
A nickel is mostly copper, about 75%. The other 25% is actual nickel. The cost of extracting, transporting, and engineering metals has gotten more expensive, so it may be time for an update. Garrett Burke is a coin enthusiast and mint watcher.
It's just the same way that we absorb in music. It used to be with vinyl, then it went digital, and now we do downloads. Well, we can't expect the composition of the coins to remain the same, particularly when the costs go up.
So the Mint is proposing
to use less expensive metals, basically have the exact same experience of the coin, but produced at a much lower cost.
Keeping the experience the same is really important for business owners who make their trade in change. Ronnie Moore is vice president of marketing for the National Automatic Merchandising Association, which represents vending machine operators.
We need the Mint to understand that a redesign of currency would change the alloy content of coins, likely in a way that would force our vending companies to upgrade or replace coin acceptors.
A process she says could cost between $100 and $500 per machine.
The majority of our companies are small businesses that are run sometimes by husband and wife teams, and the cost of compliance would be really quite staggering.
Moore says the U.S. Mint has welcomed input from her group, and they haven't made any official decisions on changes to the nickel just yet. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
It's Friday, getting close to quitting time. A long weekend, in fact, for some of us. For others, those working on Wall Street to be more specific, tomorrow and the rest of the weekend are probably going to be just like today, another day at the office. The expected work ethic at big banks, Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and the rest, is legendary. It's been around for decades. You work the weekends, which is why it's worth a note that those banks have started telling their youngest bankers and analysts something new. Don't work so hard. Marketplace's Lizzie O'Leary explains why.
At 7 p.m. on Park Avenue in Midtown Manhattan, men and women in suits are streaming out of JPMorgan Chase, UBS, and the other big banks nearby, while delivery guys on bikes drop off food.
A restaurant fuel, you know? Oh, it's delicious.
Dinner time?
Yeah.
That dinner is going high upstairs where the lights are on to the analysts and associates. Junior bankers on the lowest rung, who might work 100-hour weeks hoping they'll pay off. Saad Siddiqui used to be one of them at the bank RBC just 3 years ago when he was 23.
You go through between a month, 2 months worth of training, and after that you go into the different teams that you're assigned to.
He was assigned to mergers and acquisitions, one of the most prestigious groups. They do big deals and work long hours. Siddiqui remembers one time.
There was a deal that came in Friday around 5 or 6 o'clock, and we had to make a bid for a company by Monday, which meant that we had to work basically all the entire around the clock till Monday. I left for a total of about 3 hours during that weekend.
3 hours. Siddiqui says that wasn't always the norm, and he learned a lot and made money. But the grind was, well, grinding. He left for a job in tech.
I know a lot of analysts that go months without having a single weekend off. And after a while, you start losing your mind and you just need to kind of get away from the office.
Now the big banks are saying junior bankers have to, banning Saturday work or saying 1 weekend a month is protected, even bringing on more staff to spread out the load. The concern began last summer when an intern in Bank of America's London office died after an epileptic seizure. But the coroner noted that his hard work may have been a trigger.
there's something else going on here, too.
Right now, Wall Street is not the only game in town for really talented people.
That's Anthony Rose. He was a CFO at Credit Suisse and now teaches at Columbia Business School. Some of his students are going to venture capital firms or Silicon Valley to work in tech.
Technology now is a big driver. People are starting to ask the question of what else do I get out of it? And what they mean by that is, you know, am I going to have to work 120 hours or am I going to have a chance to spend time with my family or my friends?
Still, there's skepticism that these announcements will actually change the culture of Wall Street, where people come to make money.
You have guys and girls coming out of school with huge debt and a focus on getting a job when right now it's the most competitive it's ever been.
That's Harry Utan. His company, Faden, recruits bankers for jobs.
These guys, irrespective of perhaps things implemented by the big banks, the Goldmans, the JPs, the Credit Suisse, they're going to work. They, you know, they want to show their commitment and they want to show their loyalty.
And, of course, there are older bankers to contend with who came up in the old system and may not take to the new policies. I asked Columbia's Anthony Rose if protected weekends will go out the window if a managing director drops a project on somebody's desk on Friday at 5 p.m.
Yeah, I think that'll probably be the first real test of crunch time, deals on the table, you know. This guy's going out to the Hamptons for the weekend. I think that'll be probably the first real test of how do you actually implement this.
So a summer weekend may be the test, or perhaps earlier when a big deal happens. After all, the start of the week on Wall Street goes by the nickname Merger Monday. In New York, I'm Lizzie O'Leary for Marketplace.
Coming up, this is a perfect test case of a place that was built for one industrial era. This was all textiles. Textiles are just gone now.
You recognize that voice, right? Jim Fallows and American Futures are back. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 41 points today, about 0.25%, finished at 16,458. The NASDAQ unplugged 21 points, 0.5%, ended at 4197. The S&P 500 down 7 points, 0.4%, wrapped at 1838. For the week, the Dow picked up 0.1%. The NASDAQ powered up 0.5%. The S&P 500, however, slipped 0.2%. General Electric clicked down 2.25%. Today, UPS skidded 0.5%. Shipment delays over the holidays because of so many last-minute purchases, the company says, hurt their profits. Bond prices, well, they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.82%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday. Events take place in Washington and around the country in observance of Martin Luther King Jr. Day. Markets are closed, but national parks are open and admission is free for the day. And he was the second person to walk on the moon. Former astronaut Buzz Aldrin turns 84. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. There's a thing that happens in cities as they age. Some parts do well. They get businesses and neighborhoods and people. Other parts don't. They get run down and left behind, abandoned even. A lot of places are trying to change that, including Phoenix, Arizona, which has quite a history of urban sprawl. There are plans there afoot to connect some of the high-rises of downtown with a Latino barrio that developers have ignored for the better part of a century. Peter O'Dowd has that story from the Fronteras desk at KJZZ.
There are poor industrial neighborhoods in every big city. I'm standing in one of them with developer Feliciano Vera. With a good arm, you could probably pick up this empty beer bottle that we just found on the land he's buying.
Bottle of Cobra.
Give it a good chuck and clear the railroad tracks that separate Grant Park from the polished office buildings of downtown Phoenix. With these 14 acres of empty dirt, Vera plans to bridge the divide between rich and poor.
So this is a condition that's existed that predates statehood.
For our community to go over the railroad tracks and for the downtown people to come on this side of the railroad tracks, it's like going to China.
I asked Eva Olivas to join us at the site of Vera's proposed development. She leads a group that works to improve the local neighborhoods. In Grant Park, trees and good sidewalks are scarce. Decades of industrial use have polluted the soil. In 2012, the median income was about $19,000 a year. But Oliva says the area is rich with Latino history. In the 1970s, the now famous saying, "Si se puede," yes, we can, was coined just a few blocks from here during Cesar Chavez's fast for farm worker rights.
We have been waiting and learning and preparing for this moment. This community wants to support something.
That something could be up to 800 new apartments and townhouses, a third of them set aside for low-income residents. There's room right under a flight path for another 300,000 square feet or so of commercial and retail space.
Let me ask you, so if we have a century or more of failure to do this, what in the world makes you think
what's different?
You can do
this? What's different this time?
The answer, Vera says, is timing. From Las Vegas to Detroit, American inner cities are revitalizing.
On the macro level, nationally, obviously we're going through this period of intense urbanization.
At a community meeting to discuss the project, Grant Park residents Vanjie Muller and Nanette Parra fantasized about this urbanization.
Dream big would be to have
a grocery store.
But even though a grocery store and much more may be needed, Parra worries developers will put the community as she knows it at risk. It wouldn't be the first time in Arizona that working-class Latinos got pushed out of their neighborhoods.
They cater to those that are more educated, that are able to speak up, that are everything that our neighborhood isn't, that's what they cater to, and that's what we don't want.
There's really not an embracing of the Mexican-American culture. I mean, it's more the cowboy stuff, you know, the old West stuff.
Earl Wilcox owns El Portal Mexican restaurant just across the street from Grant Park. His family is well-connected politically, and he's used that clout to complain that the wrong development will threaten small businesses like his. Wilcox says competition from a big chain like Applebee's could wipe him out.
That's the fear.
And spoil the atmosphere of the entire place.
If they just come in historically and traditionally the way they do things, build it, and, you know, we'll worry about all these other things later, then there's going to be a lot of problems.
But if the developer recognizes Grant Park's Latino culture,
it could be something really beautiful.
In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
We've got a project going with Jim Fallows of The Atlantic and his wife, Deb, in which they fly around the country in their own small plane, seeing what they can see, with us tagging along from time to time, building a picture of what the American economy looks like right now. It's a series that we're calling American Futures.
Where we're going, we don't need roads.
Cirrus 435 Sierra Romeo, we got Tango for landing.
Sadly, no plane rides for me today. Jim and Deb are out having all the fun. Jim, it is good to talk to you once again.
Kai, it is nice to talk to you.
Where have we tracked you down, sir?
Right now, I'm in Greenville, South Carolina. I say Greenville, they say Greenville, which is also partly on the way to Spartanburg and Greer. It's in the famous upstate of South Carolina.
And what are you finding? I mean, why are you there, and what are you what's the tale to tell?
There's one relatively well-known tale about this part of the country, which is people have heard of the last 20 years. BMW has set up its only North American plant here in outside Greenville and Spartanburg. Michelin is here. GE is here. And so this is a perfect test case of a place that was built for one industrial era. This was all textiles. And even, you know, 20 or 30 years ago, it was a textile capital of the world. Textiles are just gone now. And the way that certain parts of this area have recovered and others have struggled is what we're looking at.
When you think of a textile place, Jim, that has turned into a manufacturing place, it's really often not a great story. But as you said, BMW is there, and there's other places there as well. There's other things going on there.
There are, and I've been trying to follow all the different strands of what it was 20 and 30 years ago that made this part of America appealing to Michelin and BMW after that. And there seems to be a combination of industrial heritage and then deliberate planning by state and local governments. The way they describe it is the famous public-private partnership.
Yeah.
Now, if you were in New York or Berkeley, California, you might describe this as state intervention. But here it has a long tradition of largely Republican office holders saying that they might be skeptical of the government on the national scale, but here they view governmental efforts by the state, by the county, by the city as very important to make a place where people want to live and can have jobs.
After having been there for a number of days, what's your sense, and I get that this is a tricky question based on, you know, 96 hours experience, but what's your sense of why Greenville works? Why do they not only get people, but get them to stay, you know, for the jobs and the environment and all of that?
As you would imagine, this is a question I've been asking people here, too. Yeah. And the answers range from, this is where I started out, it's where I'm from, look how nice it is. And then it comes to an answer which is unsatisfying but apparently true, which is people start naming the civic leaders who 30 and 35 years ago said, we have to shift the industrial base. We have to make the downtown come alive. We have to preserve the environment. And that's not a formula you can apply elsewhere, but it seems to be what we're hearing here.
Jim Fallows is the national correspondent for The Atlantic magazine. He and his wife, Deb, are working on a series that's called American Futures. It's in the magazine. It's on Jim's blog, and it's on our website. It's marketplace.org. And we will see you, Mr. Fallows, out on the road at some point soon, huh?
Thanks so much, Kai.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, getting us back in a way to where we started, big data and what companies know about us. Amazon has won a patent for what it calls anticipatory shipping, which is, yes, just like it sounds like, it's going to start shipping you stuff before you order it. I know. Nuts, right? The Wall Street Journal says Amazon will consider previous orders, product searches, wish lists, shopping cart contents, returns, and even, wait for it, how long your cursor lingers on an item on the web page. It's weird. It's also more complicated than I've got time for here. So check out the link on our website. It is marketplace.org. Anticipatory shipping. Don't you just love it? All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM on a Friday. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace was developed by JJ Yore. The program is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you Monday, everybody. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.